welcome to a special episode of Music for Life, a program which explores the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm Ryan Malone, concert manager for Armstrong Auditorium and host for this program. This is another one of our special episodes that I've titled Pre-Concert Talks. These episodes, only 1 hour long instead of our usual 2 hour format, will air the week of a concert at Armstrong Auditorium here in Edmond, Oklahoma. And we are coming up on another exciting event here at Armstrong. This is the famous waltz from Peter Tchaikovsky's ballet, The Sleeping Beauty. This ballet will be the second of two ballets to be performed by the Moscow Festival Ballet on the Armstrong Auditorium stage in Edmond, Oklahoma, Tuesday, January 26th. The night before, on Monday, January 25th, the Moscow Festival Ballet will perform Sergei Prokofiev's ballet, Cinderella. This episode of Music for Life will serve as a pre-concert talk for these performances. In it, we will get a brief overview of the art of ballet's royal history, we will discuss the world-renowned Moscow Festival Ballet, and we will explore the basic elements of the two ballets they are performing here at Armstrong. As stated in our first several pre-concert talk episodes, it's quite common for concert halls to provide printed program notes for concert goers. Occasionally, some will even provide a pre-concert lecture where patrons can enter the hall early and hear about that evening's program. Consider this episode one of those lectures, but one that can be consumed in an audio format such as this. For this particular pre-concert talk, or for these program notes, we will explore the Moscow Festival Ballet and the programs for its upcoming doubleheader performances at Armstrong Auditorium, Prokofiev's Cinderella and Tchaikovsky's The Sleeping Beauty. First, I'd like to give a brief history of ballet, as I think this will be generally helpful to appreciate these performances at Armstrong. Ballet is an approximately 400-year-old art form that sprouted out of the social etiquette required among nobility. Choreographed movements such as a tip of the hat and proper elevated posture eventually led to choreographed social movements set to music known as court dances. Since court etiquette in this Renaissance era was choreographed, to be in the presence of the king, you had to learn a specific set of steps or movements. To move ungracefully or to lose your balance was considered a humiliating disgrace. The poise required to be a noble at this time actually is the same poise required today of classical ballet dancers on stage. As ballet developed into a performing art, steps and technique were created, and as steps became standardized, specially designed costumes came about to facilitate freer movement for these motions. How all this came about specifically was, in the Renaissance era, Italian dukes and princes devised elaborate pageants in which courtiers danced in ornamental dress. These court dances were the springboard for ballet's appearance in the Baroque era, when these court dances were tied together with a plot line as entertainment for the king. Court dances served not only this entertainment value, but were also marks of prestige among the nobility. This was particularly true in 17th century France under Louis XIV. Dance was considered third among three principal exercises of nobility during his reign: riding, bearing arms, and dancing. Dance masters frequently accompanied the military in order to maintain their training while they were away. Jennifer Holman's book on the history of ballet says, Because physical appearance was taken to be a sign of inborn nobility, courtiers worked very hard to look and act noble. The historical significance of ballet is largely attributed to the importance that Louis XIV placed on its practice and performance in his courts. Homans writes, "It was a matter of state. As he himself later reflected, these performances captured the hearts and minds of the people. He made it integral to life at court, a symbol and requirement of aristocratic identity so deeply ingrained and internalized that the art of ballet would be forever linked to his reign. It was under his auspices that the rules and conventions governing the art of classical ballet were born." Louis XIV's efforts to propagate dance life in France included the establishment of a Royal Academy of Dance in 1661. This academy developed and codified the five dance positions familiar in ballet and used in other dance styles. These positions are the basic vocabulary of ballet, analogous to the scale in music or primary colors in art, the creation of which revolved around presentation and movement in front of the king. From this dance academy, ballet grew from a distinguished act of nobles into a profession, with people training for dance roles and receiving salaries for their involvement. Ballet moved out of the court and onto the stage. Instead of a social activity, it became a theatrical one. As this was happening, the wardrobe of dancers had to change. In the early years of ballet's history, back in the courts, nobility had placed as much attention on what they wore while dancing as they did on the dance itself. Costumes reflected more of the status of the dancer, not so much a description of the character he played. And at this time, court dances before the king were primarily performed by men. Women's dancing abilities were recognized only at social balls and occasionally in the queen's court dances. But as female participation in this art form grew, costumes that lent themselves to the freedom of movement for females had to follow suit. By the late Baroque era came the reformed ballet dress that freed female movement and paved the way for further technical advances. Eventually, this led to a shortening of the dress and the invention of the tutu, developed at the request of those viewing ballet to be able to see the intricate and quick leg movements in the art form. Now, this historical discussion of ballet has centered so far on France. Its origins there explain why almost all ballet terminology is in French, much like musical terminology is in Italian, since Italy is where music notation began to be standardized. If you were to watch the Moscow Festival Ballet warm up on our stage here at Armstrong Auditorium, which I have done when they've come before, you mostly hear them talking in Russian to each other, but then when the master gives the command for a specific exercise, I recognize all those words as French words. Despite its French roots, the culture arguably at the forefront of the ballet tradition today is the Russian culture. Ballet's roots in this country had similar roots as what happened in France. Though dance in general was a peasant activity in Russia, not a refined art form, this changed under Peter the Great. Peter strove to westernize Russia and imagined himself as a Russian Louis XIV. Peter used the same method as Louis to reform court society with the practice of ballet. Similar to the development of ballet as a whole, the development of ballet in Russia came from a desire for social and noble etiquette, not necessarily as a form of artistic expression. But as in France, it would become formalized into a theatrical art form, and the first Russian state ballet school would open in 1735. Russia has made some of the greatest contributions to the art form, many of which are still performed today, thanks to the compositions of Peter Tchaikovsky and the choreography of Marius Petipa. More on this later. So what began as pomp and prestige among nobility led to the creation of an art form based on poise and plot set to quality music. It wasn't until ballet progressed to America that its movement was based on something other than activities of a court society. Watch a ballet today without this history, and one can still be entertained. But with this history, one can deeply appreciate the ideals behind the art form's grace and strength, and its royal value still being displayed on stages today. You are listening to a special episode of Music for Life. I'm Ryan Malone, concert manager for Armstrong Auditorium and host for the program. We are discussing the Moscow Festival Ballet and its two-night series of performances at Armstrong Auditorium here in Edmond, Oklahoma, Monday and Tuesday, January 25th and 26th. This program is another of our pre-concert talks for the various performances we'll have throughout the season here at Armstrong. The Moscow Festival Ballet was founded in 1989 by the legendary principal dancer of the Bolshoi Ballet, Sergei Radchenko. Radchenko graduated from the Moscow School of Dance in 1964 at the age of 20. After 25 years of working with the Bolshoi Ballet, Radchenko wanted to establish a new ballet company that combined the highest classical elements of both the Bolshoi and Kirov ballet companies. Today, Radchenko is the artistic director of this company of 50 dancers. Since its inception, the Moscow Festival Ballet has toured all over the world. In addition to commissioning new works from within Russia and abroad, the company also performs classic ballets and specializes in 20th century full-length ballets such as Sergei Prokofiev's Cinderella, which they will be performing at Armstrong Auditorium. So let's talk now about Prokofiev's Cinderella. First, I want to give you a brief overview of how the plot is handled in the ballet, then we can talk about some of the great music in this work and how it specifically underpins and highlights the drama being danced on stage. The ballet is divided into three acts, and the first two acts will be separated by an intermission. Act 1 takes place in Cinderella's house, and it's the typical scene, for those familiar with the tale, of Cinderella being forced to clean on behalf of her stepmother and stepsisters, meanwhile longing for her real mother. While the rest of the family attends a grand ball that the kingdom's prince is hosting, Cinderella dances with a kitchen broom to assuage her loneliness, but she soon bursts into tears. At this moment, a beggar woman who had appeared at the house earlier, and toward whom Cinderella had acted kindly, comes back and changes into a beautiful fairy godmother, and then she transforms the kitchen into a forest. She gives Cinderella a pair of glass slippers, and the fairies of spring, summer, autumn, and winter perform for her, changing the seasons as they dance. They transform Cinderella into a beautiful sight so she can attend the ball, warning her, though, that the transformation will only last until midnight, and thus ends the first act. The second half of the show takes place in two scenes. The first scene is the palace, where the ball is being held. The second scene is back at Cinderella's house. At the palace, an acrobatic jester welcomes the guests. We see the prince, and then ultimately the transformed Cinderella, with whom the prince falls in love immediately. That's how it works on stage, folks. And you know the story. When the prince and Cinderella are dancing together, the clock strikes midnight, and the title character has to rush from the ballroom, leaving behind only a glass slipper. And don't worry, the ballerina isn't actually dancing in a glass slipper. The final scene takes place back in Cinderella's house. As Cinderella reminisces on the ball, the jester, prince, and other courtiers come to the house in search of the glass slipper's owner, and you pretty much know what happens next. The prince is overjoyed to find his mystery princess. Cinderella forgives her stepmother and stepsisters for their previous cruelty. The prince returns the glass slipper to the fairy godmother. The kitchen is transformed into a glade where Cinderella and her prince dance a beautiful pas de deux, a French term for a dance duet, meaning step of two. Also, typically, it's the romantic duet between a male and female dancer. Now, how does Prokofiev use his musical score to help tell this story? Well, like in any stage production of recent history, he assigns specific musical themes to various characters and ideas of the drama. Three major themes are attributed to Cinderella herself and are developed throughout the ballet. They are introduced in the movement titled Cinderella in Act 1. The opening theme, the first of Cinderella's themes, is in a minor key, which is commonly associated with feelings of sadness or emptiness. This sets the tone for the environment in which the drama begins. The second theme is in the key of C major, a total contrast to the first theme. This lyrical theme gives a sense of happiness and beauty. The second theme reappears several times throughout the ballet, but in different keys and orchestrations, indicating the development of her character, possibly. The third theme is also in C major, reflecting this childlike simplicity again. This melody has a small range and first appears on a flute. So let's listen to this Cinderella movement from Act 1. Here it is performed by the London Symphony Orchestra with Andrei Previn conducting. That was the Cinderella movement from Act 1 of Sergei Prokofiev's ballet of the same name. This is where we are introduced to the title character and the musical themes that Prokofiev ties to her. And that was Andrei Previn conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. Another prominent musical motif in the ballet is that assigned to the fairy godmother. Her theme first appears in the piccolo and oboe. The unusual combination of this high piccolo with the poignant oboe gives the sense that there's something peculiar going on in the story whenever this character is around. Underneath those instruments is a cymbal with flutes, a harp, string section tremolos, where the bows are being moved rapidly up and down across the strings to give the sound a trembling effect, all of which gives a beautiful shimmer to the sound. This is the movement from Act 1 called The Beggar Woman, which is the form in which the fairy godmother first appears in this drama. This is from the same London Symphony recording. So that was the Beggar Woman movement from Act 1 of Cinderella by Sergei Prokofiev. Since the Beggar Woman is the fairy godmother in disguise, we are introduced at that moment to the musical themes Prokofiev uses for the fairy godmother. The ugly sisters and stepmother are also characterized by specific instrumental cues in the orchestrations. In their preparations for the ball, Prokofiev writes a roll on the tambourine to depict almost a hissing at Cinderella. Their themes have more aggressive rhythms and no real chordal resolution. The first trumpet plays a tricky, clumsy melody. The oboe's melody is also what you might call angular. And the celli are playing in an awkward register. Here is the movement from Act 1 titled Dressing for the Ball, and you can hear these musical ideas that Prokofiev assigns to the ugly sisters and stepmother. Thank you. That was the movement Dressing for the Ball from Act One of Sergei Prokofiev's ballet Cinderella. We are exploring some of the musical themes that Prokofiev assigns to different characters of the production. That was music associated with the ugly stepsisters and stepmother. The other main character we'll discuss is the prince. His melody, as you might expect, employs trumpets and a more traditional brass sound to give his music a certain nobility. This movement is from Act Two, Mazurka and Entrance of the Prince, and it's a representative example of this. We are listening to the music of Cinderella, some of the themes that composer Sergei Prokofiev assigns to the different characters. That was the entrance of the prince. We've been hearing a recording of the London Symphony Orchestra with conductor Andrei Previn. The music from Cinderella has been used beyond the dance performance even. While working on his ballet, Prokofiev himself also completed three piano transcriptions of the production's highlights. Music from the ballet also recently found itself in the soundtrack for the 2015 film The Avengers: Age of Ultron. Let's listen to now perhaps the most famous theme or section from this production. This is the Grand Waltz from Act 2.
Thank you.
You are listening to a special episode of Music for Life on KPCG. I'm Ryan Malone, concert manager for Armstrong Auditorium and host for the program. We are discussing the Moscow Festival Ballet and its two-night series of performances at Armstrong Auditorium here in Edmond, Oklahoma, Monday, January 25th and Tuesday, January 26th. This program is another of our pre-concert talks for the various performances we'll have throughout the season at Armstrong. So we just heard the famous Grand Waltz from Act II of Prokofiev's Cinderella, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra with Andrei Previn conducting. Cinderella will be the first of two performances from the Moscow Festival Ballet here in Edmond. Now let's talk about the second ballet to be performed, Peter Tchaikovsky's The Sleeping Beauty. Tchaikovsky is considered to have composed three of the greatest ballet scores ever written. He loved dance so much that some say he put as much effort into writing his ballets as he did into writing his symphonic or operatic works. The Sleeping Beauty was the second ballet that he composed. Although his first ballet, Swan Lake, had not been very well received, he was eager to accept the commission to write music for a ballet based on this 18th century tale by Charles Perrault. He was so passionate about and devoted to the composition that it took him only 40 days to complete. And in a letter to one of his benefactors, he wrote, "The subject is so poetic, so inspirational to composition, that I am captivated by it." One factor that heavily influenced Tchaikovsky's composition of The Sleeping Beauty was the occasional company that he had of a three-year-old girl, a daughter of a friend's servant. The presence of children brought out a different side of this composer, who was usually very somber and sensitive. Having the company of this one little girl at times during the period that he was composing The Sleeping Beauty inspired him to make this score much more lighthearted than his previous works. This ballet is in three acts, with the prologue and Act I being in the first half of the Armstrong Auditorium performance, and Acts 2 and 3 occurring after intermission. Like Cinderella, this story is somewhat well known, and I don't need to rehash it here, but I do want to talk briefly about how the plot is handled in this dance production and alert you to some of the great moments in Petipa's choreography. The prologue introduces us to the six fairies whom King Florestan XIV asks to watch after his daughter Aurora. This is also when we are introduced to the wicked and bitter fairy Carabas, who curses the infant Princess Aurora. The curse of death on her 16th birthday can't be broken, but it is able to be modified by the Lilac Fairy, who's really the female lead in this production. Now Aurora won't die, but will only sleep for 100 years until awakened by the kiss of a prince. So Act 1 begins when Aurora turns 16. When we first see her, she bursts onto the scene dancing a brief and vivacious solo depicting the carefree nature of a young girl. Thank you. She is then ceremoniously introduced to the four princes who have come to seek her hand. The Rose Adagio, the famous dance scene expressing a young girl's blossoming into womanhood, is about to start. Aurora begins the adagio with one leg raised and bent behind her, one curved arm raised overhead. A bent limb is referred to in ballet as attitude. Some have read in this attitude pose, which Aurora repeats often, a kind of gentle questioning or youthful uncertainty. One after another, each of the suitors turns and displays her while she maintains her pose. She releases the hand of the suitor supporting her and, raising both of her arms overhead, balances momentarily, as if tentatively testing her abilities. She then takes the arm of the next prince and begins the sequence again. After a brief interlude in which the princess dances alone, she returns to accept a rose from each of the suitors, hence the title, Rose Adagio. And we are hearing music from the Rose Adagio here. She pirouettes slowly and accepts each rose. One prince supports her while the next one offers his flower. At the end of the adagio, she returns to her attitude position, and supported in turn by each prince, she again releases her hand and balances for a little longer each time. Finally, as she frees her hand from the clasp of the fourth prince, the curved attitude straightens into a sharp arabesque extension. She retains her balance poised confidently on one toe, as if she has visibly come of age before the eyes of the adoring suitors. The princess continues dancing a joyful solo until her attention is suddenly distracted by a strange woman dressed in black who offers her an unfamiliar object. Before anyone can stop her, Aurora seizes the dreaded spindle. The unwary princess pricks her finger, grows weaker, and falls to the floor in a swoon. Just as those assembled lapse into despair, the lilac fairy steps forward and summons a forest of thorns, thickets, and enormous shrubbery to grow around and protect the sleeping princess. And then we have an intermission. Act 2 takes us to a neighboring kingdom 100 years later, where Prince Charming and his entourage are hunting. This is when the lilac fairy shows the prince visions of Aurora. The prince is utterly taken by this sight, depicted by the princess dancing lyrically amid a tableau of fairies and nymphs bathed in a blush light. After this vision, the lilac fairy offers to take the prince across the lake, through a dense entangled forest, to the castle where the real princess lies asleep. He approaches the canopied bed set on a high platform, and as the music heightens, he awakens her with a short kiss, which is indicated by the gong, and then she greets him. This leads us right into the final act, which is the wedding. A series of celebratory dances are performed by the inhabitants of Fairyland, Puss in Boots, Bluebeard and his wife, Goldilocks and a Bear, Little Red Riding Hood and the Wolf all dance. A highlight is the pas-de-deux of the soaring Bluebird and his princess. First dancing together and then separately, they compete with each other, spinning and fluttering in sparkling flight, sometimes jumping so high they seem virtually suspended in the air. The man's variation in particular, which features many beating jumps while he arches his body backward and forward, is one of the most famous and demanding in the international repertory. The Bluebird's dance ends with the female lifted on the male's shoulder. The celebration then climaxes with the grand pas-de-deux danced by the prince and princess. They are regal, formal, and confident dancing together. Prince Charming, like any good man, supports his bride's pirouettes and displays her long extensions and secure balances. The prince jumps and spins during his solo, and the princess spins on point with even surer mastery than she showed in the Rose Adagio. Finally, Aurora whirls into the prince's arms and dives toward the floor. The prince catches her around the waist and supports her in the famous inverted pose known as the fish dive. You might even see this on some pictures of the Sleeping Beauty CDs or posters. All join the bride and groom then for a spirited mazurka, and the lilac fairy standing in their midst bestows her blessing on the happy couple. Now, as for the music, Tchaikovsky gave almost every character in the Sleeping Beauty a unique motif. Most notable are the leitmotifs for the Lilac Fairy and for the Wicked Fairy Carabas. As you might expect, whenever Carabas is about to enter the scene, the music becomes dark and menacing. Tchaikovsky does this with the horns and the darker woodwinds accenting the offbeats, while the clarinet plays a foreboding chromatic melody. The timbre of these instruments is used throughout the ballet to represent Carabas's mysterious and vengeful character. In contrast, the Lilac Fairy has a soothing, uplifting theme that is ornamented by glissandi on the harp. Tchaikovsky's score even supplied some of the music for Walt Disney's animated rendition of The Sleeping Beauty.
I know you, I walked with you once upon a dream. I know you, the gleam in your eyes is so familiar a gleam, yet I know.
A song from that movie, Once Upon a Dream, is based on Tchaikovsky's Garland Waltz, which is the ballet's theme for Aurora and the Prince, that famous movement we heard at the introduction of today's program. This song has become one of Tchaikovsky's most recognizable melodies.
The way you did once upon a dream.
So in today's special episode of Music for Life, one of our pre-concert talks, we have explored the Moscow Festival Ballet's upcoming doubleheader performances at Armstrong Auditorium. For more information on this, you can visit armstrongauditorium.org. You can follow at Armstrong Odd on Twitter for updates on its performing arts series, and you can follow this show on Twitter at MusicForLifePCG. MusicForLifePCG. My special thanks today to Sarah Pravatsky, Alicia Lancaster, and Emma Smithies for their help in putting together today's program. To end today's program, let's hear the rousing procession of fairy tale characters from Tchaikovsky's The Sleeping Beauty. This is from another recording of the London Symphony Orchestra with Andre Previn conducting. You might recognize the dance rhythm of this, which we've talked about on this program before, a stately three-beat-per-bar pattern known as a polonaise. Enjoy this procession of fairy tale characters from Peter Tchaikovsky's The Sleeping Beauty. And I hope to see you at the ballet. Thank you. You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.